Welcome, folks, to episode 3,477 of the Survival Podcast today. I'm excited to have my good friend and expert council member and longtime community member of the Survival Podcast, Sean Mills, on the show with us today. Sean has been around so long that he was at the first ever workshop at Nine Mile Farm, the first one we ever did. So that's been a while, and he's helped a lot of you guys out over the years as an expert council member and just as a good dude in the community. He is a professional engineer specializing in solar and other power needs. And he's going to talk to us today about a kind of a deep dive into energy-related tax credits. That's a sophisticated way of saying getting the government to pay for some of the cost of developing your own energy independence. And generally, that would be by getting your own damn money that they stole back from, you know. There are people, whenever I talk about any kind of subsidy or tax credit or whatever, like, you're just taking government money. What kind of libertarian are you? And I'm like, I'm the good kind. The kind that gets every damn penny back from those jackasses as they could possibly do. And so we'll be talking about that and channeling that in a way that will make you more energy independent. We'll even talk about some risk to the grid today and some other things. Sean and I were chatting about just a few moments ago. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is KnifeKits.com. These guys have been with us since 2010, and it's 2024. That's 14 years as a sponsor of the podcast. That's a long time. I've never had a heat email come in that like Knife Kits screwed up or something. Like everybody that uses them is happy with them. They have so many cool things that you can use to learn to make your own knives. If you're like a master bladesmith, you can get raw materials. If you are just learning, you can get kits. There's everything in between. You can get stuff to make Kydex holsters and Kydex sheaths. You can get stuff to make leather holsters and leather sheaths. And then they have really cool, like the mosaic pins for the knives. That's just one way to customize and personalize. And they do a discount for MSB members. So check out KnifeKits.com today. Next up today, JM Bullion. You know, I have been recommending the exact same ratio on silver and or gold in your wealth portfolio since the day I started this show. 5 to 10% should be in silver and or gold. And, you know, as I got into Bitcoin, people have asked me if that's changed. And unlike a lot of people that call themselves Bitcoin maxis, no, not for me. I do not believe that all eggs go in any one basket, no matter how great that basket is. And I do have an extreme value that I see in silver and gold long term, and especially silver because of applications that it has in things, you know, like renewable energy and medicine. Just as one place where you have these what you call inelastic demands. The thing is, where should you get your silver and or gold? Well, I think you should get it from JM Bullion. Why? They've been a sponsor of the show for over a decade. They do a discount for MSB members. No one gets a discount on silver and gold except my members. I just don't see that happen anywhere because the margins are so slim. They have a great track record with us over that time. They've taken care of any little problems that have ever come up. I have the CEO and president directly available to me at any time if there is a problem. I haven't had to contact him with one for a very long time. And they're just a great company. And I'll tell you what, I have been approached by larger silver and gold companies. And somebody asked me the other day, why did you tell Lear Capital to go screw? Because I said, I literally told them to go screw. Well, I just watched a commercial on Fox News where they were talking about silver's about to explode. And the guys that were saying it were like Robert Kiyosaki and a bunch of other ass clowns. And when you look at the fine print, the video that they were showing was from 2019. But it's about to explode. See, I don't like people that use hype to try to sell things. Silver and gold speak for value themselves. Deal with JM Bullion. You know you can trust them because I do. It's where I get my silver and gold and where you should too. With that, let's go ahead and bring Sean on stage with us here. And Sean, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack. Thanks for having me, man. I'm glad to be back on the show today.
And you've been around, like I said, forever, but there are probably people that will listen to or watch this episode. Never heard of the Sean Mills before, don't know what one is, wouldn't know where to find one if they went to look for one. So before we dig into the topic, can we have you just kind of introduce yourself? Like, how did you end up becoming an engineer? What was like, you know, and how did you end up kind of not only being in like the solar space really heavily, but working so much with people on like the homestead level and all? Because you were more, and I'm really not sure exactly what you're doing now, but really heavily into like the commercial space.
Yeah, so it's a long, winding road. I got into industrial construction right out of high school, And one of the very first jobs that I had a leadership position on was a power plant. And so for the next 23 years, I primarily worked in industrial construction. And while I've been in literally every sort of industrial facility that you can think of, I was mostly in power generation. So from trash burners to nuclear plants, solar concentrated. There's a lot of things you don't really see anymore. But like if you've ever flown into Las Vegas, you can see the Eye of Sauron out in the distance with the mirrors all the way around it. And we actually worked on that project. And so I've literally been involved in every single way there is to generate electricity in the United States. And really in the mid-2000s, like right after the 08 financial crash, I started getting really concerned about how fragile the grid was altogether, not even just the individual pieces of the grid, but the whole thing, which you experienced 2 years ago during the snowpocalypse there in Texas. And so I went off grid myself, moved my family to an off grid property, and we were able to get that property for very cost effective rate because it wasn't attached to the grid. Then we put our own system in for a quarter of what it would have cost to bring power up to the property. And then, you know, really through being involved in your community, Jack, I launched Hack My Solar years ago and really focused primarily on solar systems. And then a couple years ago, expanded that out. So hackmyhomestead.com is where you can find all of my stuff. And I've branched from just the energy part out to water systems, gray water systems, black water systems, in the process of spinning up a new company this year that's focusing on vermicomposting toilets. And yeah, my goal is to help people get out to cheap raw land, easily develop that land once they get out there, and get their utilities in place. If you think about, you know, $20,000 to bring in a power system and another $20,000 to put a septic tank system in, and then who knows how much to try to find a hole in the ground that you can get water out of with a well that can cost from $10,000 to $100,000 depending on the property. You know, those are significant barriers to entry for people that want to get out and homestead and get out of the city. And so really my target customer is someone that's willing to do a lot of those things themselves, and I can help them with the design and the consultation to step through those projects to get them in place for between 10 and 25% of hiring someone else to do it.
That's awesome. And just to back up your thing on the well stuff, I had to put a new well pump in last year. It cost me about $3,500 for the pump, and I could have saved about a grand by doing it myself, but I let somebody do it with a warranty. And so it cost me about $4,500 all in. Well, while the guy was here, I'm always interested in careers for people to pursue and all. So I was asking about what he does and all. And they don't do any drilling. They just work on the wells. But they work with drillers. And I was talking to him about how hard it is to get a well drilled, how so many of the drillers are, like, they're basically attached to the hip still to oil and gas companies because they need wells wherever they go. And even though they drill oil wells, they don't drill water wells. And that guy knows I'm getting a job, and the money's green, and so they don't want to pull off of that. I said, what would it cost me to get a well here, which you know is all limestone right now? And he said, well, it costs you $30,000, but you'll wait 6 to 9 months before somebody shows up to do it.
Yep. And so if they don't hit water, you still pay.
But the time is crushing.
Yeah. And if they don't hit water, you still pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they got to go to a different part, on your property, it probably wouldn't be a problem.
Doesn't matter.
But if you've got a 100-acre parcel, there's spots where you're going to punch through into the aquifer at 200 feet, and then there's other spots where you might have to go 600 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. My place in Arkansas, the well there was 690 feet deep.
And it was about, imagine paying to get that one pulled and replaced.
Yep. And that one was about in, like, once they got water, they went like another 40 foot. They were like, because it costs so much to set up, like, just keep going. And they went like another 40 foot down. And my one here, when we pulled the pipe, we had about 30 foot of wet pipe. So that was encouraging. But again, your point on the expenses is valid. Let's back off that though a second. Let's talk about something really simple. Explain what's going on right now with residential solar energy tax credits and tell us things that the average homeowner may have heard of this, but doesn't know about it.
Yeah, sure. So, in general, what happens with a solar system is that the federal government will reimburse you for 30% of the total cost to install a solar system. And it doesn't matter whether that's a system that's just going to put power back on the grid, if you've got a net metering system, if you've got batteries, it's a 30% tax credit. And that is in effect at that rate through 2032. Okay, so some of these rules were changed with the Inflation Reduction Act. And so they actually bumped it back up to, it had gone down to 22%. So they bumped it back up to 30%. And a tax credit, for people that don't understand that, that's a dollar for dollar reduction in your tax liability. So if I have a tax deduction, that just reduces the amount of income that my tax rate is applied to. But a tax credit is a dollar for dollar reduction. So if I have a $30,000 solar system that I put in, I get a $9,000 tax credit. That's $9,000 off the bill that I have to send to the IRS at the beginning of the year. And we've got this coming up in what, 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Right. Week and a half. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this kind of running joke where you have to work from January to May just to make money for the government, and then you can start making money for yourself. And so imagine if you can take tens of thousands of dollars of the cost of a system that you were going to put in anyways and reduce that time. Maybe now you're just working from January through March to pay for the government. So this applies to solar systems. It applies to wind power systems. It applies to geothermal systems. It applies to micro hydro systems. And a new thing for 2023 to 2032 is battery systems. So it used to be you only got the tax credit for the battery portion of a solar system. Mm. Now, as long as you're putting in a battery that's at least 3,000 watt hours, which is relatively small, okay?
Yeah.
A battery bank of at least 3,000 watt hours, then you get the 30% tax credit on that as well. So that it makes it a lot easier for people to step into a system, because now I can go inverter battery bank, get my tax credit this year, and then next year I can look at adding solar to that system and get another tax credit, and then I can expand batteries or solar from there. So I really like I don't like a ton of the things that the government does. But if they're going to give me some of my money back for doing something that makes a lot of sense from a personal resiliency standpoint, it makes a ton of sense to just take advantage of it.
And just I'm saving most of the questions for the end here, but we'll hit this one here since clearly this was misunderstood. The dollar for dollar that Sean's talking about is based on 30% of spend. So mm-hmm. What Builder of Castle says that if you owe 10 grand this year, just go spend it on solar. Well, that would give you a $3,000 credit and reduce your tax burden to $7,000. You're still out $7,000 to the government and $7,000 on your solar array or whatever it is you put in. The point here is not the government will pay for it. If you need it anyway, you want it anyway, you can get some of your money back from the government to help pay for it. Or I guess another way would be to look at it is if I have a $10,000 budget, well, that $10,000 budget just became like $13,900. That would be another way. Like I can actually do more with less, you know, I want to say less out of pocket, less actual cost. Because it is, you're going to pay it and then you're going to take it off that tax year's tax burden.
Exactly. Now, here's an interesting thing, and we can dig into this a little bit in depth later. But if you finance the system, you still get the entire acquisition cost as this year's tax credit. So if I were to take out a loan for the system,
okay,
I still acquired the whole cost of the system this year, even though I'm not paying for it for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so obviously, you know, with the rates the way that they are right now, that might not be a great idea. But if it's a massive barrier to entry for someone and they're good at managing those costs, or maybe you have a paid for homestead and you take out a home equity line of credit, use a portion of that to not a home equity line of credit. What's the other one?
I don't know. Second mortgage?
Actually, it's a second. Because a home equity line of credit, I don't think the interest is tax deductible, but a second mortgage, it would be. And so if you did that, you could utilize that methodology to pay for the system get the tax credit for the entire amount this year, and then any interest you paid would be deductible. So you're kind of hitting it on the both the income and the tax liability side.
Yeah.
And with the idea that if my home continues to increase in value, that essentially the cost basis increase is more than what I end up paying for the system.
Gotcha.
It's a great idea for someone that's going to put a system in, knowing that they're going to sell the house in 5 years.
Yeah, that would be one way to look. I guess another would be like, let's say you did finance the system. Let's say you went 50% down and 50% financing. Well, then when you get that 30% rebate back with your tax return, you throw 30. Now you're sitting there with your financing at only 20% of the cost of the system. There's like, it's up to you to figure out how the structure works for you. The point is, for every 10 grand you put in, you got 3 grand coming back. That's
absolutely.
That makes more sense to people for some reason than 30%, but it's,
yeah,
it, you know, that's why the metric system is cool, even though we don't want to use it. Like, it's all divisible by 10, so it's really easy to think about. You know, you mentioned the Inflation Increasement Act. They called it reduction. But one thing in there that actually seems useful that you mentioned is battery storage has been added as a clean energy credit. Can you talk about what that means? Because I think there is I think it costs more to put battery in than it does panel in right now.
Right, right. And when we think about this, so you tell people, get a generator, store 12 months of gas, right? And so that is a great idea. But the other side of that is if the grid is off for whatever reason, I have to have the generator running to have power. Okay.
Correct.
If I had a very small battery bank that was tied into my house's system, and I just, the grid just keeps it at 100%. I only use it when the grid's off, whether that be because it's not reliable in my area or there's a storm or any other reason, then now when I run that generator, I can run it at a higher efficiency level and I can charge up the battery while I am running those devices, and then I can use the battery power. And so that's a good idea just in general, right? It's a good idea because if we have something that looks like a week-long power outage, especially if I'm closer to a suburban area where there's a possibility like Katrina, where you had people walking around, oh, I hear a generator. There is someone that's got some stuff. I'm going
to
go grab it.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If I need to get gas during a power outage and all the gas stations are sold out of gas, like it happens every year down in Florida when hurricanes come through, guess what? If I hear a generator, that guy's got gas guaranteed.
Yep.
And so the idea that I can run the generator for a shorter period of time, charge up a battery bank, and then have that battery bank actually power the loads in the house makes a ton of sense. And again, now let's say I do that and I put in a little small sub panel, right? And the sub panel is just the critical load circuits that the battery is going to handle, or the generator if it's on. Well, now the cost of putting that sub panel in, I get a tax credit on that, right? If I just put a transfer switch in on the outside of the house, run a few circuits through it so that I can plug my generator into it, there's no tax benefit to me to do that.
Okay.
So if I'm going to do that anyways, I can go get, you know, $1,000 worth of battery and attach it to it, and now that whole thing is eligible for the 30%.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Because my accountant brain is going. So what you're saying is, let's say like the cost of the project is like $2,000 without the batteries, right? The transfer switch, all the shit to make that work. And then I throw $1,000 of battery on top of it. Instead of taking 30% off the grand, I'd take 30% off the $3,000 because it's part of the total system.
With the exception of the generator itself. But yes,
I got
all the wiring, all the conduit, all the
wiring, all that shit. The electrician work,
yep.
Right? That all goes into being part of the battery backup system.
Absolutely.
Huh. That's fun.
And if you put it in the right
stacking.
Yeah, and if you put it in the right way, then you can easily add solar or additional batteries to that down the road. Right? So it's one of those, like you said, the function stacking thought process of, okay, I'm going to do this system because I'm trying to build some resiliency. Mm-hmm. If I just add a little bit of incremental cost to that, Now I'm eligible for a tax credit from the government that helps pay for that system, makes that system pay for itself faster. Now I've got different use cases. And again, I'm not putting any real difference in terms of the inverter. The inverter is still going to take that battery voltage and turn it into alternating current for my house to use. So if I just do that and have it to where I can plug some solar panels into it as well, the government's helping me to pay to become more resilient.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. But there's another way to look at this too. There's also like energy efficient home improvements that qualify for this as well. And, right. And while you're answering that, is there any way to maybe make a thing that isn't the whole thing is like we just did with that? Is there any way that might happen?
So you're talking about like improvements to the house envelope itself?
Yeah. Like I think there's like certain things, certain types of insulation or something mm-hmm. like that, or new certain windows would then become energy enhancement and therefore subject to this.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a whole list of what they call a building envelope improvements that you can do to a house. Now, here's something that's important to understand. When we're talking about the solar or the investment tax credit that applies to solar, geothermal, wind, microhydro, okay. battery, you can use that on an existing house or a new house. Okay. When we're okay. talking about this other category, which is improvements to the housing envelope to make it more energy efficient, that only applies to existing houses. But to put that in perspective, Jack, you know those cans of spray foam that you can buy to go around your windows and doors
yeah.
if you put it? Yeah, that is building envelope energy efficiency improvements and therefore subject to a tax credit. So, so let's walk through a couple of those categories. If you replace your door, and really what you want to look for here is the Energy Star label. Okay. If you replace a door, the government will give you 30% of the cost of your door back up to $250 per door, up to $500 per year. There's no annual there's no lifetime maximum. There is an annual maximum to this, but no. So you could put in two doors on December 31st and two more doors on January 1st, right? Windows. And so they're really, if we're talking about the home improvement side, there's two categories to this. And I know it's a little bit convoluted. So right now we're just talking about building envelope. We're talking about keeping air and water out of your house, right?
Okay.
Generally. We're talking about windows, doors, skylights, insulation. Okay. So the annual maximum for any of those categories is $1,200 or all of those categories together is $1,200.
So when you say $1,200, is that $1,200 in tax rebate or $1,200 and then 30% of the $1,200?
$1,200 in tax credit.
Okay.
So whatever the math would be, 30% of that would be the maximum.
Okay.
So $1,200 in credit per year is what you can get back for those expenditures. So if I spend $1,000 on a door, the 30% of that would be $300, but I'm capped at $250 per door. Okay.
Gotcha.
So, spray foam insulation, Tyvek house wrap is one of these. Again, it keeps the air out of your house. So if you're doing a renovation or an adjustment to your house or, you know, whatever the case may be, any of those little small categories that keep air out of your house, keep the heat and or cool out of your house, are eligible for the tax credit. And there's a super wide, range of different things that you can do to actually take advantage of that tax credit.
See, and I think we have to start thinking a little bit differently, too. Like, this isn't just like, go do this thing because it's there. What do you have to do already as a homeowner for maintenance and upgrades? Let's say that you're at a point where, like, it's time to replace some windows in this house. And what you can end up doing is buy a window that's 100% better and costs 30% more, but for the same real price in the end. Like, I was going to do the windows anyway, but if I go with these windows that are eligible for the credit, I can spend up to 30% more because I'm going to get the money back. And that is the mental shift. Like, I jump to that like that. I guarantee if we had Nicole on with us, she's going to, because we run businesses. So we think that way. The average person does not think that way because we're not taught to think that way.
Yeah. So I had a house down in Alabama last year that I had to put a brand new roof on.
Okay.
And as I have guys coming through talking to me about their different specialty roofing materials and all of this stuff, one of my questions was, are there any upgrades to underlayment or any upgrades to anything involved with this other than just the sheeting and the shingles that would help increase the energy efficiency of my house? Okay. Because the idea is if I spend an extra $10,000 on that system, then my house acts more efficiently. So it's easier for me to heat and or cool. So I'm going to start getting money back on that investment.
Yeah.
The government's going to give me a piece of that investment back, right? There's all these different layers to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different ways to make it pay for itself. Now, the reality was in that specific situation, the only roofing material that had something that would have qualified was like a $50,000 increase in cost. And so it didn't make any sense at all at that point.
Yeah.
But it was a question that I asked. And then here's the other thing. There's people that have done these projects and they just happen to have used those components and had no idea that there's a tax credit available to them. So that's one of the nice things about getting on with you right now is if you had a renovation done to your house last year that used doors or windows or skylights or insulation, you should go back and look at your receipts and see if there's some money that you can get back from the government for this project you already did.
Yeah, definitely. And I've also heard some of the like energy efficient appliances, like you mentioned, any Energy Star qualify for this too. Like, and I guess you got to start thinking that way too. If I'm right about that, then if I'm going to go buy a refrigerator and freezer for my kitchen, because my old one is ready to be a beer fridge in the garage or it's just done, I can buy a much better unit that's more energy efficient and get money back on it. Is that right?
So it doesn't apply to all appliances.
Okay.
It specifically applies to climate control appliances. So your fridge or your freezer would not work, but an air conditioner, a mini split heat pump, a ducted heat pump. I don't know if you've seen these, but they have heat pump water heaters. So it's an electric water heater, but it's super efficient. And guess what? It outputs air conditioned air. So you could actually duct your air output from your water heater into a space that you wanted to cool, for example. Those are eligible. How about a wood burning stove or a pellet stove, right? You can actually, you know, as long as you're meeting a minimum requirement, those things. Then on top of the stuff that we talk about all the time, so like the heat pumps, mini splits, heat pump water heaters, even if you're replacing just like a wall mount propane heater, right, which I did last year. I don't even use the dang thing, but I have to have it for insurance purposes because insurance won't let me use wood as my only source of heat. So I replaced a wall-mounted propane heater last year, and I paid $17 extra to get the version that had the right efficiency rating to get a 30% tax credit on the whole deal.
Wow.
$17, and I'm going to get like $140 back on tax credits for spending that extra $17. Okay. If you have an outdoor biomass wood boiler, you know, so there's some, this you see a lot more in the Northeast, where they'll have like the outdoor boilers. If you're replacing one of those this year, if you get one that has the right efficiency rating, again, 30% tax credit. And so on the appliance side, I mentioned on the envelope side, you're limited to $1,200 per year. On the appliance side, that number goes up to 2,000. And one of the other things to remember with these, what I'll call improvement tax credits, is those you can't roll forward. Okay. You really want to plan your expenditures if you've got a couple of these different things happening to where, you know, maybe I'm maxing the tax credit out on category A this year and then category B next year and so on. Whereas the solar investment tax credit, if I have more tax liability or rather less tax liability this year than I've earned credit for, I can roll that differential forward. So it's just like an investment loss, right? If I have $30,000 in tax credit this year and I end up only owing 10 grand, I can roll that 20,000 in the next year and the next year and the next year. But you can't do that with the other side, with the energy improvement things like the insulation and the wood stoves and things like that. That you have to take that year. There's no roll forward.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's cool. And that's important to know. Right. Yep. And because you might make some different decisions. Like you said, you do the expenditure end of December, beginning of January, and split the expenditure. Right. So you divide it into those two tax years where something that you can do a rollover, you hit a cap, you roll it over, you go ahead and make the expenditure now. That makes, again, these are things that if you run a business, you immediately snap to. But the average guy going to work and back every day with a W-2 doesn't, it's not that they're not smart, as they just don't. Right. Have to make decisions like this on a daily basis. So
exactly.
We think differently. And they damn sure aren't going to teach this in school, though. It'd be great if they did. There's that one movie with the dude in the car, and he's like, sure, be cool if you did, right? Like, I can't think of what movie that is. So you mentioned wood-burning stoves. Is there anything else about those, you know, before Paul Wheaton shows up, if we say his name three times, like Beetlejuice, and starts screaming Rocket Mass Heater?
Yeah, so the biggest thing that you want to look for there is you want to look for a wood burning stove that has at least a 75% efficiency rating. Okay. So thermal efficiency rating is what you're looking for. These days, it's hard to even find one that doesn't have that.
I heard him.
Oh, did I drop for a second?
Yeah, you did. I told him already in the live chat, we've both got storms. I don't know if you can hear it. I've got thunder that's shaking the freaking windows over here, but I think I've got pretty good filtering on it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's pretty windy out there, so it's probably hitting my Starlink.
Yeah.
So 75% efficiency is the key number here. Thermal efficiency. It's hard to find one on the market these days that that isn't at least 75%, and this applies to the pellet stoves as well. But yeah, essentially, you get a $2,000 tax credit. Which, you know, let me rephrase, you get a 30% of your expenditure tax credit up to $2,000. And this includes labor. It includes your stove pipe. If you got to cut a hole in the wall or the ceiling, to run this, all of those costs are included in this tax credit. It's not just buying the actual wood stove itself.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's really cool. Let's talk about something else, and then I want to dig into some grid risk as we talk about this. There's also tax credits for electric vehicles, whether you want to buy a big-ass Cybertruck and look like Doc Brown in Back to the Future with his DeLorean, or the little Model 3s or whatever. Like, there are tax credits on all that, right?
Yeah, so my general thought process around EVs is that new are just overpriced. Like, you're paying for the status of driving a brand new EV. But if you go buy one, there is a $7,500 tax credit. And, but here's the one that I like actually more than that. You can get a $4,000 tax credit for buying a used one, right? So you can go find a, you know, 3 or 4 year old, Model S or something like that, that you can get at a reasonable price these days, and get a $4,000 tax credit for that. Now, just like, you know, I'm sure everyone kind of saw in the media, there was all this play back and forth of you know, USA built versus union built and all of these other, all this other nonsense around that. If you're looking at an EV, I would suggest that you go to, I think it's energy.gov. They actually have a list, and just Google this, just Google what EVs are eligible for a tax credit. And they'll actually tell you make, model, and the years that are eligible. So that's super important, because like for the $4,000 tax credit, it's limited to 30% of the price. It's got to be less than 2 years old. The purchase price has to be under $25,000. So if it's $25,001, you get zero tax credit for it.
Wow.
There's also income requirements. So like if you are single and you make more than $75,000 a year, or married and make more than $150,000 a year, you can't claim this tax credit. The battery has to be a certain size. Like it's just, it went from like, hey, this would be a good idea to utilize taxes to incentivize things that we want. And then you get all of these people screaming about, well, what about this? What about that? And now you've got this super convoluted rule that's in place. But in general, if it's a new EV, you're going to get $7,500 tax credit. And if it's a used EV and you jump through all of those other individual hoops, you can get up to a $4,000 tax credit.
Okay. Okay.
And there are places where the EV could double as the battery bank for the house, right?
Okay.
So you can. So here's the other thing. If you put in a small charging station at your house,
yeah,
you can get another tax credit up to $1,000 for the cost of the charging station. Okay. Mm. So now when we talk about stacking functions, imagine now I've got a solar system at the house.
Okay.
Tax credit.
Yep.
I've got a transfer switch at the house that's tied to a battery bank. Tax credit.
Tax credit.
I bought my EV, which is going to double as a battery bank for my house. Tax credit.
Okay.
And I've set up a charging center where I can actually charge it, you know, during the weekends when I'm home when the sun's out, from the solar system. Tax credit. Okay. So now I'm stacking these different credits together to do something that I may have wanted to do anyways. I'm adding that resiliency. And again, if as long as you put in one of those systems where the charger works both directions, where you can actually pull from the system or put back onto the system, now your car can become a battery bank as well.
Huh. So not only does it function as a battery bank, it also rebates as a battery bank.
Yep.
That's how we have
it. It just has different limits.
Yeah, I got you. I like certain things though, just being able to add this thing and then the whole system cost becomes like that's actually genius, because there's a lot of people you'd say, well, do you want to add this? And they would say, I do, but I don't really have the money.
Mm-hmm.
But if effectively this one component pays for itself because it's itemized or percentile against the entire cost,
Your incremental increase in cost could be less than the amount of tax credit that the whole system now you get.
And the rest of that shit you were going to do anyway. Oh, he's locked up again. Elon, fix Starlink. Hell, let's see what we're going to ask Sean next when he's back.
Yeah, sorry about that.
There he is.
I saw the wind and I knew it was coming.
Yeah, yeah. That's like when I was on Sat Internet, same thing. Now, before we go on from there, I want to actually talk about a little bit about the grid risk right now. Mm-hmm. There's two huge things I see going on right now that I see as the biggest risk to the grid, other than like terrorism, hacking, all that shit, or CMEs or whatever. One is places like Texas, so we have this massive influx of, you know, inter-country refugees. People are like tired of New Jersey and New York and whatever. And we're growing at this ridiculous rate. And they're doing jack diddly shit to increase power generation in a way that is commensurate with the population growth. Turns out new people want electricity too.
Yep.
Then you're this idea that we're going to have 20, 30% of the U.S. vehicle fleet as EVs, you know, by 2028 or whatever. We don't have the power to do that.
Right.
And you can write all the articles you want for Vice and the Huffington Post or whatever that comes up with these fantastic jelly bean field fantasies that, well, we don't have to all charge at the same time, but everybody is going to charge at the same time. Everybody goes to work, gets off at 5, comes home and plugs the damn car in. Like,
right.
What do you see? Like, is it even possible to do what they say they want to do right now? Like, if everybody got together and actually was trying to fix the problem, is it fixable? And then we know that's not going to happen. So what does it actually look like?
Yeah. So a couple things there. One of the things is we are in fact adding a significant amount of generation to the grid. Okay. Every year. But we're adding the thing that everyone needs to understand about the grid is with very, very limited exceptions, there is no storage on the grid. All right. Mm-hmm. So that means that when I turn my light on, more power has to be put on the grid
than was there before.
And then when I turn it off, guess what? That power has to come off the grid. Okay. Too much power is just as big of a problem, if not more, than not enough power.
Gotcha.
Actually, not enough power is easier to deal with. When we think about what happened with the Texas snowpocalypse, you've got all these generators on the grid. And these generators in these massive plants work exactly the same way that your generator does at your house. You have something spinning that has a magnet around it, and that creates current. Okay, that's it.
Yep.
And so what happens when you plug your generator in and, let's say, try to run your well pump or some big load? You hear it bog down, right?
Yep.
So what happens is you have increased electromagnetic resistance in that spinning piece, okay? And you actually need more power to overcome that, right? And so what happened with the Texas grid is that every generator on the entire grid is actually synced, which means they're all spinning at the same 60 hertz, and the sine wave for every single generator is the same. This is very important.
Yeah.
Because if we get out of sync with the rest of the grid,
we can
do that for a short period of time, but not a long period of time. Okay. And so what happened in Texas is the grid as a whole dropped down more than a 1% difference from 60 hertz, right? 60 hertz being the rate of rotation of every generator on the grid. That can happen for 9 minutes. On the day after, on February 15th.
You know why I'm laughing about 9 minutes?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
No.
That was the increment in the controlled outages. They were going 9 minute. So you'd be on for like 36, off for 9, on for 36, off for 9. And I was watching, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was like 2 degrees out. And I'm watching a timer, and like right at 9 minutes, the power would come back on.
Yeah.
And you'd hear like heater kick on, and then it'd be like, 36 minutes, power went off, and it did it like 3 times.
Everything in multiples of minutes.
And the third time, it went off, and I'm like 11 minutes. I'm like, oh, we're fucked. I was like, as soon as it went over 9 minutes, I'm like, yeah. I didn't know that was why it was 9 minutes, though.
Yeah, at 9 minutes, the breakers in these generators will basically disconnect themselves from the grid. Okay.
So you just did that everywhere.
So, but here's the key. The whole grid in Texas was more than 1% off for 4 minutes and 37 seconds, meaning the entire Texas grid was more than halfway to being all the way off.
All the way
and
off.
And when you go all the way off, you're talking weeks to months to come back on. Okay. So this is why ERCOT, which is the Texas Reliability Council, was going to these different co-ops saying, you got to shed load, you got to shed load, you got to shed load. Because if we stayed underneath this 1% differential for more than 9 minutes, everything turns off. So as
like
you said,
well, Jack, you're going to fucking suffer so that the whole state's not out for a month. And
exactly.
And I was happy 4 or 5 days of it. I'm back on power. That was way
now. Imagine everyone gets home and plugs their supercharger in at the same time.
Yeah.
What happens? The grid starts getting turned off. Same thing. It's the exact same thing. If you don't have enough generation that you can bring online to meet the current demand, you've got a 9 minute window before you have to start shedding load.
Okay.
And so this was just, that happened to you guys in Texas, and ERCOT doesn't even cover the whole state of Texas. Okay.
No, it's like 80%.
The Eastern Interconnection runs from the Continental Divide, base of the Rocky Mountains, to the Atlantic Ocean. Okay. So if you imagine that whole grid is synced to each other, to itself.
Yeah.
And the exact same problem could happen if we have massive either increases in load or decreases in generator output. Okay. So we were talking a little bit earlier about transformers. Okay. If one of these big transformers gets messed up, you're currently sitting at 100 to 125 week lead time to replace it. So in these big switch yards, what you'll normally have is a company will have 4 super transformers in a bank, but only 3 of them will be wired to the actual grid, which means that if there's a problem if one fails for whatever reason, they can just disconnect it and switch over to the other one. And no one knows the wires. And as long as they can get that fourth one replaced with a new one before there's another problem, then no one ever knows. Okay.
I got you.
But there's 55,000 substations in the United States. So, any guess how many you need to take offline for the entire grid to go down?
Probably one.
Nine,
okay. Yep. All right.
If you take the right nine off, there's no grid in the U.S.
I was in my former life when the big Northeast power outage hit, and I was in Midtown Manhattan. And, boy, I'm glad that didn't happen since everything fell apart up there, because it would have been chaos. Right. It would have been chaos riots. Like, it was actually really orderly. The hotel I was staying at had backup generators. I walked into the desk. I'm like, am I going to be able to get in my room and order from the bar? And like, as long as you pay cash, I'm like, all right. So they had a little outside seating area. I sat out there and drank a martini and watched everybody walk across the bridges and tunnels, right? Like,
yeah.
I can't imagine. And they said it was very close to, like, if a few more went down, like, the whole damn East Coast was going to go down.
Yeah. You know what caused that one?
No.
A branch. A branch fell on a power line, and so what happened when that happens is that you just route grid power around that section.
Yeah.
Well, this is all automated. All right. It's all computers that do this work. And so essentially what happened is the computer didn't route it properly and overloaded the section of the grid that was next to that section, which caused that section to drop. And then you just had a cascading computer failure, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah.
And basically what happened is Jake Robinson with a lopper saw. That's probably what did it right there. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to pressure test the system.
Huh. That's that. Yeah.
And we haven't even talked about the impact of AI, Jack. Like, you talk about AI all the time. Where do you think the power comes from? These massive data centers, you know, all of these data centers that are getting built all over the place to house the brain of Watson and all these other massive AI computers. Right now, worldwide, data centers account for about 2% of the total global demand for electricity. Okay. All right.
And that's all data centers. That's Amazon Web Services. That's AI. That's everything.
Correct. Correct. But AI is what's driving the increase in demand more than anything else.
Yeah.
Okay. And the cool thing is that all these, you know, APU manufacturers and GPU manufacturers, like, they know the exact number. Like, they don't have to guess. They're like, okay, if we sell this many APUs and GPUs and they get put into service, we know exactly how much power that is.
Take the spec sheet, multiply. I mean, like,
exactly.
What you're saying.
In the next 5 years, you're going to double that number. So we're at 2% of global demand right now, and in 5 years we're going to double that number. Now, whether that's 4% or some other percentage,
who knows?
But
it's,
we know
it's
that
raw power needs.
We know that since Al Gore invented the internet, we've gone up to about 476 terawatt hours per year, and we know that in 5 years we'll be about 1,000 terawatt hours per year.
So
yeah, where's that going to come from?
You tell me if I'm crazy. If I was, you know, I don't want to be president because I can't do anything, but I would be king for a 4-year term, right? Right? Because I could get some shit done. Like, and if I'm looking at this right now, and I hate all this tax bullshit, you know that I'm an agorist, but like, it's the system we have, and we're talking about these rebates today and all. Like, my whole focus would be get as much battery power into the customer premise as possible. I would be subsidizing freaking things like whether it's Tesla power walls, whether it's some other solution. I don't even care. I don't want to be a king maker. I'll just be the king. So I'm not going to pick one brand or anything. But like, put as much smart battery power as you can at the customer prem as possible. Mm-hmm. Because that allows that like, during low usage, those batteries to charge up. And when somebody comes home and plugs that Cybertruck in, it's pulling more from the battery than it is from the grid at that point. That would be number one. And number two, like, this would be my moonshot. We need to have like a 30% reserve of every kind of fucking transformer attached to the grid any fucking where that there is a fucking transformer now. Like, if we have to start stealing them from some other country, if we have to build a factory to make them, the idea that we would wait over a year to replace a transformer is the dumbest fucking thing that I've heard in the 2000s. Like, I don't know there is a dumber move a country can make than to allow that to be the case. And I think if we did those two things, we wouldn't fix everything, but we would go a long way toward alleviating this.
Absolutely. And I would focus more on the first one than the second one, right?
I agree.
So the second one takes care of the transformer issue with the grid, but there's a bunch of other issues with the grid, you know? And so, and you're not going to transformer your way out of a cyber attack or a hurricane or a tornado and on and on and on and on. Okay. And so, yeah, I would do the same thing. I would put as much storage in local places as I could, and I would encourage the utilities to build microgrids. So we have these 5,000 house subdivisions, right, that get built all over the place. Imagine if every one of those houses had its own battery storage, and you could share that storage with other people just in that neighborhood, okay, and, you know, get paid for it at the same rate that the power company does. So if you're putting power back onto the local microgrid, the guy down the road who's got his air conditioner set at 68 degrees in the summer, right, he's going to use more than he can store, but he's not going to see any difference in his bill. The only difference is that you, as a neighbor who thinks a little bit more, you say, you know what, I will allow my battery to go down to 50% to help supplement these local loads. So now we don't have transmission losses. Okay. Now, if there's a power problem on the other side of the city, it doesn't affect us over here. And so, I would do those two things. I would do the two things that you mentioned, and I would add, let's have some local resilience in the grid and allow people to share, power with their neighbors versus this pie in the sky thing where
you're talking about transmission loss there. And like, I don't know if you've heard me say this before, but all these eco weenies talking about, oh, but you need solar and wind. Whatever. I'm like, you know what? If you can't tell me what attenuation and impedance are without Googling it first, you don't get an opinion on any of this. Like, these are the most basic electrical concepts that these people and the politicians making policy can't tell you what attenuation is. They can't tell you what
impedance. They can't tell you what any of this stuff is.
They don't know what any of it means, but it's like that's why I use the term jelly bean field, which I totally ripped off from Lewis Black, the comedian Lewis Black. He was doing something about solar like 25 years ago. And he said, oh, I thought the power came from a fucking jelly bean field, you know? And I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. That went in my repertoire forever after that. Because, this stuff can't just be conjured up. And that's a big thing people don't understand. Like, I put this huge power generation facility in, but it's over here. Like, I can only send that power so far before I start having major loss. Power generation versus power delivered is not a zero sum. It's a net loss across the transmission. And that's why things like, you mentioned like AI and all. Okay, these are always on, always drawing situations. They can't you can't really just shut down ChatGPT. Because you have paying customers going, where the fuck's my ChatGPT at, right? Bitcoin miners are setting up close to these situations so that they can take all that surplus power while it's available. And when they're like, oh, we need to load shed 2%, they can just shut off. And when they say, hey, the power's available again, they can turn back on. And it's literally seconds on either side. Amazon Web Services can't do that, right? My 100 terabyte server company can't do that. The ChatGPT can't do that. People don't understand, like, the AI thing. Every time you go, please give me a list of 50 plants that grow in salt marshes, there's a shitload of GPUs going, brrr, and they're just burning power to give you that answer. It's a massive amount of power. And that's why I think there'll be some sort of gateway flow cost against it, because these companies right now, they're operating on the Skype model. Doesn't matter how much we lose in the beginning, as long as we build the client base, and eventually we can make money. Or the Amazon did the same thing. Amazon lost money for 10 years. Right. But you can't do that forever with a hard cost like energy. Like, you have to at some point create some sort of, especially on like APIs and shit, because right now you can literally have one AI unit cause another AI unit to generate agents that tell other AI units what to do. And if you're running that with APIs, which is programmer talk, but basically it means it's all automated, you can have all kinds of shit going on everywhere, and there's no human actually requesting anything.
Right.
So if you think about
something that let's just say you have to research for, and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to research item A, and then, okay, well, I learned something new that makes me now need to understand what item B is. Oh, and then item C impacts that. So the AI kind of does that for you. It steps through those different things. But you're exactly right. If I send ChatGPT, a really well-written prompt of how I want you to do this thing for me and consider mm-hmm. these things, it may be spinning up 7,500 other computers to grab all the different data sources needed and then compiling them before it can even output something. And so, yeah, you see these massive spikes. And here's the other thing. There's a lot of wholesale energy buyers, right? So people that are like building data centers and things like that. And part of their contract is preferential treatment. And so the more like that, basically the power company guarantees that as long as the grid is
Bitcoin.
Up.
Reverse Bitcoin miner, right? Instead of you shut down, we make sure you stay up.
Yes. Ugh. Yes. So now if I need that power or you need it to keep your pipes from freezing in your house, you don't have that agreement with the power company that I do.
And that may sound insane, but there's a reason for it. I remember one of the projects we were on, a guy with a backhoe cut a 900 pair cable going into a JCPenney call center. And it was very expensive. I think it was something like $750,000 of downtime that the company and their insurance company ended up on the hook for, because that was the value over time of that call center. So think of something like an AWS, server farm that's serving 20,000 websites, 20,000 sites, and they're not all just straight up e-commerce sites. Some of these sites are very, maybe they're AI, right? They're subscriber-based real-time payment type. Like, it could be millions of dollars over a few hours in lost mm-hmm. business.
So why would I agree to build my plant here unless I've got assurances from the power company that I'm not going to have any downtime?
Wow. Yeah. So, do you think that maybe, since we're talking about these tax credits, like maybe wake up and maybe focus more on stuff like that? I remember like it was like test subsidy, and it was some little power company in New Hampshire, and it was like you could get a power wall for $1,100 installed. And I'm like, bring that here. I'll just write it. I'll $6,600. Bring me six of them. Put them on the back. Right. Like I wouldn't even think about it. Like I would just do it.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the benefits of my previous life is that I had access to the C-suite of most of the power generation companies in the United States. And I asked that exact question to the president of Generation. I won't mention the name of the company, but it's in the southeastern U.S. And I said, why aren't you doing more of that? Because you're going to get the money either way, right? If you discharge this during an outage, guess what's happening when the power comes back on? You're going to charge it back up. Right now in Florida, if there's a hurricane and I crank my generator, guess what? I'm not buying gas from the power company, right?
No.
So that's revenue for power generation that's going, instead of to FP&L, it's going to Shell, right? And so that was my question, was you can capture a big piece of that dollar figure if you just have behind the meter storage in people's houses, because what's going to happen if the power goes down? They're going to use that storage before they crank the generator. And if you've got enough storage to where they don't have to, you get to keep all the money, because when the grid comes back on, you just charge the batteries back up.
Now, you and said earlier that I didn't ask you about them, but you made me think of it now, because I don't think, maybe I heard it wrong. You said there's no storage on the grid, but there is storage. There are some storage battery facilities. They're just really not building them anymore. And to me, you need this. So if I'm Edison Electric or whatever, I would rather take the money that I would spend to build like a giant battery bank that can all be in one place and all be attacked in one place and all fail in one place. I'd rather distribute that on my customer premise. And it would seem that there seems like there should be some opportunity here for like the government rebate thing to shake hands with the power companies being willing to subsidize some of this, because I'd rather put 1,000 power walls on customer premises than have that amount of storage at my substation.
Right. So, yeah, there is a small amount of storage on the grid. There are actual batteries on the grid, and another way they store power on the grid is they pump water to an elevated place when they have extra, and then drop that water through a mountain into a hydro plant when they need extra. So those are the two places. Now, to put that in perspective, Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, has put more money into power storage than any other locale in on the planet. And right now, they can run off of their power bank for about 3 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not good. So energy density is a problem with batteries, with actually batteries, like how much.
Yeah.
So a gallon of gas has a certain amount of power in it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You would need about, let's see if I can do the math right. You would need about 400 pounds of lithium iron phosphate batteries to store the same amount of energy as there is in a gallon of gasoline. Okay. So that's one of the big issues. You would need about 400 pounds of lithium iron phosphate battery to store the same amount of energy as in 1 gallon of gasoline.
Which weighs about 8.5 pounds.
Right. So that's the big problem.
Ratio.
So, but like you said, if I can spread that weight out over 150 million households,
mm-hmm.
okay, then it seems like that's an easier problem. But there's two issues with that. One, if I have a battery bank in my house, then both the grid and the people that the grid lobby have less control over me. Okay. And so no way that that the power companies are going to get on board with that. And then what the actual VP of generation told me was anything that we do behind the meter, we can't prevent the customer from messing that up and causing other problems. And then we're on the hook for the liability side. He said, so if we could figure out how to do the behind the meter thing where we still own it, but the customer gets the benefit and we get the benefit without the liability, then we would absolutely do it.
See, I think they could take a lesson from telco there. When you look at telephone communication systems, there'll be what they call a DMARC on the side of the house. And you literally can open one side and that's the side that goes into the house. And the other side, you could open it, but you need a thing called a can wrench to get in there or really thin needle nose. And that's the company side. It would seem like there'd be some way to build intelligence into something like a power wall mm-hmm. that essentially I control the power, but it's on the other side of the meter, but I only pay for it when I draw it through, but it's dedicated to me other than for those load sharing things. Something like that, where if the power goes off, I'm the one that gets that power, right? But while there's a load sharing thing, the power, because it would save them so much money, because it's not just that they don't have to build battery storage. They could build less power generation than they're going to have to build, because they have to build, they call these like peaker plants, right? Because I have to be able to generate, you know, let's say power rating 1,000. It doesn't mean anything, but just a random number, 1,000. But I'm normally running at 500. Right. But because it's an on-demand system, I have to be able to peak up well beyond general need at any given time, even if it's only for an hour. But if that distributed storage, then I can get through that period without putting excessive draw on my power generation. So I have the capital deferral in that, use another business term, is like hundreds of billions of dollars.
They think that the government's going to step in to fix all the T&D issues. Yeah. So there's no impetus to making that step. And that the capital that we're talking about, they didn't even have it as a potential cost because none of these companies believe they're actually going to have to fix it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going on. The government thinks the industry will do it, and the industry thinks the government will do it. And the lobbyists don't care who does anything as long as their checks get signed.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. We don't care what we're fighting about as long as there's a fight.
So are there any strategies that people can use to maximize and combine these credits? I think we hit that pretty good, but just is there anything we've missed? There you are.
And I'm back.
All right. Well, I don't know if you heard what I said then. Are there any strategies we missed in the beginning about like how to combine these credits and do things so that we maximize them?
Yeah. So, I mean, my favorite one is the law does not define what a ground mount is. Okay. I have two ground mounts at my house. One, I happen to park underneath. And the other happens to have chickens underneath it.
Okay.
And that means that the government paid for 30% of my carport and 30% of my chicken coop.
So these have solar panels on them when you say ground mount, right?
But it's an elevated ground mount that happens. It's an elevated ground mount that happens to look a lot like a carport. Like most people would call it a carport, but it's not. It's a solar ground mount. So I think that's one of my favorite ones is kind of getting cute with having elevated shade structures that you put solar panels on, and the entire cost of that structure is now eligible for the tax credit. Jake in here, he had to re-roof his house. And he went with a specific style of roof that was going to make his roof strong enough to support the weight of a 60-panel solar array. So a portion of the cost of his standing seam metal roof was eligible for the tax credit. So how aggressive your CPA wants to get and what you take and what you don't take. But so, for example, my chicken coop, okay, the only part of my chicken coop that is not eligible for the tax credit is the wire and the door, because 100% of the rest of that structure had to be built to hold my panels up. Yeah. So the door hardware and the chicken wire is not going to be part of my tax credit. If I ever were to get audited, I'd just say, look, here it is. And then after I built it, I decided to utilize the structure underneath it for something else.
And having been through an audit, they're not coming to your house to look at it.
Right.
Right. That's not how that works. Like, you have to be able to answer the question in a way that satisfies the auditor that the deduction is legitimate. Right. And the other thing I'll tell people just from experience is, like, most people that are sitting around shitting their bricks, worried about being audited, you're never, ever, 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 ever infinity going to be audited. There's like a less than a 0.5% chance. Right. If you make less than $200,000 a year, that you are going to be audited because you're not worth it. What you'll get is a letter of demand. And I've had some of those too. A letter of demand and an audit are not the same. One is an inconvenience. The other is like having a proctology examination without sedation up to the elbow. I mean, they are totally different experiences.
Yeah, and here's the other side of that. You got a lot of new IRS agents out there, and you've got a lot of the old guard retiring.
Yeah.
So what you'll find, and look, these guys are not quoted, right? They're given a taxpayer identification number and told, here's the audit, here's what we have, and here's what doesn't match up or whatever, right? So most of the time, you just email them the information that they're looking for, and you might add some, you know, some receipts and things like that, and that's it. They're like, oh, okay, no problem.
Yeah.
Like the high level, we're going to come out and forensic accounting your situation. No, it's not happening.
No.
You've got to be – they've got to think they're going to claw back tens of millions of dollars from you before they're going to get to that level of involvement. And at that point,
the sweet spot for targeting is sickening. It's small businesses with turnover between $2 and $6 million, because they have enough money to get a big check. They don't have enough resources to be like, here's my 47 lawyers, talk to them. Because when you audit somebody that runs a $1 billion company, that's what you get. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the companies I worked for was about a $10 million company. They seemed like they got audited every 4 years. And they always did okay, but it was incredibly expensive and painful to go through it. And Sean has locked up again. Come on, Elon Musk. Shake that satellite. There it is.
There it is.
So are there any, because we've been talking about business a little bit, any energy-related tax credits that are accessible for commercial businesses? And might that be another way to stack some things? Like, my business is using this one with a cap, and my household's using this one with a cap, and they both have separate schedules, even though I'm the taxpayer.
Yeah. So with the business, there is the 30% tax credit, and this is for systems that are under a megawatt. So the assumption is you're not a power generation company. You're just a business that's going to put solar or one of the other technologies in and power your actual business. So you can get the standard 30%. Investment tax credit that a homeowner would be able to get. Now, the other side of this is that there is another credit where the government will actually pay you for 10 years per kilowatt hour that you generate. Now, there's a lot of additional strings attached to that. But if you put a system in and you can get, let's say you just have a relationship where you can get very cost effective components where maybe the actual 30%, like your cost isn't as high. So the 30% number doesn't look as attractive. You can get paid to generate for 10 years at a rate of 2.75 cents per kilowatt hour. And then there's two adders to that as well. So if you use prevailing wage labor, you can get another 30 cents or 0.3 cents added on top of that. And if you're in what the government considers a special low income area, you can get another little addition. So if you build with the right labor in the right spot, you can actually increase that 2¼ and 3/4 cents per kilowatt hour a bit. For most facilities, the 30% tax credit is going to be the way to go. But there are places, like I said, where maybe if you're a solar manufacturing company and you're going to build this little small thing, like a warehouse somewhere, and use your own labor to do it, those are the type of situations where them paying you for your production actually makes better sense. But in general, if you're a company, there's a different set of rules you have to follow, but you can still get the 30% tax credit of the total cost of the system. And when I say total, that's design cost, permitting, wiring, the actual components. If you have labor, if you have to pay the power company's engineer to come out and test your system before they turn it on, every single one of those costs is eligible for that tax credit and no cap.
That's pretty awesome. We also live in a country where about half of the people that think of themselves as taxpayers don't pay any actual tax. There's people that just don't make enough money to pay tax, but they have money. There's not-for-profit corporations. Since this is a tax refund, basically, so it reduces my tax burden. If I already owe zero, how does that work? Does it matter to me at that point?
Yeah, actually, this is a new thing with the Inflation Reduction Tax Act that went in place. So if you're a nonprofit organization, so any of the 501s, whatever comes after 501 doesn't matter. Any of the 501s, you can actually apply to get a direct. All right. They didn't want me to tell you that part.
Right.
What's the last part you heard, Jack? Sorry.
So basically, it sounded like you were saying that I think where you were going is you can get money from the government as a nonprofit, even though you don't owe them any tax.
Yeah, if you're a nonprofit, they will pay you the amount of the tax credit in cash. If you are not a nonprofit, any tax paying citizen can actually sell their tax credits. So the tax credit is transferable. This is brand new.
Oh.
And so let's say, for example, you're retired and you manage your withdrawals from your system so that you have zero tax liability on a year-to-year basis. But you want to put a solar system in. Yeah, we got the big red part of the storm over us right now. Sorry about that. In a nutshell, you can sell your tax credit. Now, I'm not sure what the market looks like that for these days.
But
you can absolutely sell your tax credit to any person who owes taxes. It could be your brother. Okay. So that's changed with this last Inflation Reduction Act. Nonprofits can get paid directly, and if you're a taxpayer that actually doesn't owe, then you can sell that tax credit to someone else.
If I wasn't making any money this year, I could sell my $3,000 tax credit to Jake Robinson for $2,500.
Yeah, the only thing you have to do is there is a website that you have to register to be for that tax credit transfer system. And Jack, I sent you that link this morning, so you can put it in the show notes. If you're someone that wants to, that's literally the only thing. And essentially what happens is when you file your taxes, you do it like you're going to get the tax credit. And then you put in the information of the person who bought the credit from you. And then that's it.
And it transferred. And the price is really between us. I mean, it's a fair market. It's cap and trade for the little man.
It really is. Like you could say, I think it's a business opportunity as well. So someone that might want to target folks that have the money to put a system in but don't have taxable income, a person could help those people get their system in place, fill out the forms so that they can transfer the tax credit, find buyers, and then maybe just take a commission for the amount that's getting transferred.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jack Spirico. Does your company sell solar arrays to boomers? Contact me for how I can help you sell more for no cost out of pocket, right? Something like that.
Exactly right. Exactly, right.
Yeah, and that's who your market would be. Boomers putting in solar arrays. And the yep. guy that knocks on their door and convinces them to do it, that's like, I don't get a tax credit because I don't pay taxes. Well, let me show you how we can fix that for you. That's kind of cool. So let's wrap up before you get taken out by the wind again. tell people how they can learn more about you and work with you.
Yeah, so a couple different things. Hackmyhomestead.com is my primary website. I have actually published a few ebooks since I went full-time last year. If you go to hmhs.info, so HMHS for hackmyhomestead.info, that'll actually forward you to my Linktree account, and you can actually find the different ebooks there. And then if you go to solartaxbook.com, you can actually buy an ebook that I just published that runs through all of this information in greater detail, as well as has some links to different places that you can go to help you. So if you're either getting ready to do your taxes or getting ready to plan out some expenditures for this year, solartaxbook.com, you can buy that ebook. It's less than $20. I guarantee it'll pay for itself. And yeah, Hack My Homestead. I'm on all of the socials at Hack My Homestead. And if you are interested, let me just throw this last plug in, Jack. So one of the new companies I started earlier this year is Terra Toilet, like Terra for Earth, terratoilet.com. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm helping people put in vermicomposting toilet systems. So it's a septic alternative system. All in, you'd be in for less than $1,000 if you bought all the components and built it yourself. It's a flushable toilet that uses compost worms to get rid of the waste. And it costs, 5% of what an actual septic system would be.
Well, when you sign off, shoot me an email with that last link, because it's the only one that's not in the links you sent or on here. And maybe Jake will buy a Terra toilet from you. Because I want to make sure I include that one. And I just know as I wrap up and all, it's going to go right out of my brain and I'll forget to do
sure.
it if you don't.
Sure.
So ping me with that and I'll make sure all the links that were on your app, all the links you sent me today, plus the Terra toilet, worm toilet, will be on there as well. Cause this has been really cool, John. Thanks for being with us and thanks for powering through the Elon wave out there with the storms.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, folks, with that, I hope you enjoyed the show. And it was definitely worth powering through a few lockups. If you're listening on audio, you're like, I didn't notice it being that bad. That's because when I get it on the audio editor, I'll pull those blank spots out for you. But if you're watching the video, we just had to deal with it to get through with it. Anyway, real quick before we sign off, I didn't plan it this way, but my item of the day today actually is power backup related, but on a much smaller scale. I'm sure this doesn't qualify for a rebate on your taxes, but Anker's Astro E7 26,800 amp hour backup charger is on sale today. It's on a limited time deal. And I've gotten really good at recognizing what is going on with Anker. I've been recommending Anker for years. I've been recommending this product for about 5 years. A product like this has a life cycle and it goes away. It has never been on sale marked down as much as it is today. It's marked down like 36%. And they had dropped the retail, so that even brings it lower. This is a product that routinely sold for about $75 to $80 normally. I think you can get one today. Let me look at it real quick. I think it's I don't have the price. Let me look at the price. Let me make sure it's still on sale. It is $42. And this is probably the best external battery backup charger for like all your mobile devices you can get. The thing is a tank on quantity. Now, here's why I'm kind of taking some extra time with this. First of all, limited time deals, they mean exactly what they say on Amazon. They go away. A lot of times they're one day or part of a day. And it just so happens here at 1:20 in the afternoon Central Time, it's still for sale. When Anker does this, I would say the probability is about 85% that when this deal goes away, this product's going to go away. I just told you that recently with a set of earbuds, and guess what happened? Kind of my new favorite ones right here from Anker. They're gone. They disappeared, and they get that little message. We don't know when or if this item will be back in stock. This is a pattern with Anker. If you want, like, the biggest tank that you can get at a reliable price from a reliable company that always stands by their shit, Anchor. I have one that's 4 years old. It still works like brand new. That's pretty impressive, and that's with a lot of cycling going through it. I use it all the time. It'll charge an iPhone from zero multiple times. Don't let your iPhone go to zero, though. It is just a great product, and Anchor is just my favorite discount brand for electronics. Anchor and eTech City are two companies I know. If you buy their shit, if something goes wrong, they're going to fix it. And at this price, I would get it. Remember, you can find that and everything that I recommend at a little domain, tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z. .com. If you buy anything starting there, whether it's on Amazon or from the VVOR store where you get additional discounts, it helps the show and the work that we do. And all it does is take you a little extra time to get my recommendations, which are all products I know, I use, I bought, and I'd buy again, or I wouldn't recommend it to you. With that, I'll wrap up. Tomorrow we'll have an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and then we'll do a Friday flashback. But I got one more thing for you right now. I'm just looking for some input here on how I give this thing away. What would be some ideas you might have so I can give this away to an audience member? Vivor, who I've been working with, sent me this awesome chicken coop automatic door. So you could set this so either when it gets light or dark, it opens or closes, or you can set it by time. And you might be thinking, well, Jack, don't you want an automated door for your chicken duck coop? I would love one. I thought this was a great idea, but I wasn't sure until I got it, because they give you dimensions and all, but you got to get it in your head. As soon as I got this, I looked at it and said, you know what won't go through that hole, at least not reliably, and might get stuck in it? A big, giant pilgrim goose that will not go through that hole. A chicken will go through that hole. A duck will go through that hole. A goose is not going to fit through this door. So I don't want to cut a hole in my chicken coop and put a door in there and create a goose block and end up with my goose stuck in there. So I'm going to do a review on this, show how it works, et cetera, put it on the website and make it available for those of you that it works for and be able to say, I actually have used it, tried it. I know that it works. But after that, it's either going to sit in my shop or I'm going to give it away. And I thought it would be a cool idea to give it away to a member of this audience. If you have an idea for a contest that I could run, because I think Vivor would really dig something like this, TSPC in the subject line, email it to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, and let me know your idea. And whoever gives me the best idea, we'll go ahead and do that, and I'll figure out some way to reward that person. But no, I won't give you the door, because that would defeat the whole purpose of the project. And no, Jake, you can't have the door. With that, take care, guys. Appreciate you. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.